Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm Ray Kotke. Today we are joined by staff members of the ALT News Weekly to discuss breaking news in their upcoming issue.
Then, Julia Kavicki and Carolyn Kessner join us from Skidmore College to discuss combined sewer overflows.
Afterwards, we will talk about the business of art with WOOC correspondent Kim Tateo.
We'll also hear from WOOC correspondent Dan Pfeiffer in his continuing series about data justice.
And we'll hear about empowering women via documentary film. Let's start now. Let's start the show off with some rapid-fire local headlines.
The mayor of Troy announced Monday that the city will solicit public input on the future development of the One Monument Square site in downtown Troy. The city will hold a three-day public design session where participants will collaborate during a multi-day brainstorming and design program. The city is supporting a 50-foot deep esplanade along the Hudson River and connection from the esplanade to River Street.
Led by the Republicans, the New York State Senate voted to increase the state funding to help schools pay for armed police and security upgrades Monday, but turned back Democratic efforts to advance new restrictions on firearm access.
Another winter storm is expected in the Capital Region on Wednesday, with snowfall of 7 to 12 inches, with localized amounts of up to 15 inches, the National Weather Service predicts in a winter storm warning.
The first ever practice day kilt crawl, held exactly 1 week before the holiday, will kick off at 2 p.m. Saturday at more than one dozen locations throughout downtown Troy. Attendees are encouraged to wear kilts while they warm up for St. Patrick's Day during this March 10th event, presented by the Troy Craft Beer Committee in partnership with the Downtown Troy Business Improvement District. Several brewed in Troy beers will be on tap at all sites.
South Korea says North Korea has agreed to impose a moratorium on tests of nuclear weapons and missiles if it holds talks with the United States. South Korean officials who recently visited North Korea said the North also made it clear that it wouldn't need to keep its nuclear weapons if military threats against the country are resolved and it receives a security guarantee. The North also promised not to use conventional or nuclear weapons against South Korea. South Korea says it has agreed with North Korea to hold summit talks in late April.
The Times Union reports that Milton Town Supervisor Scott Ostrander, who ran on a campaign of ethics reform, is now violating the town's ethics law by asking prospective new Board of Ethics members to apply through him. Two members of the Ethics Board recently resigned after town officials insisted on appointing to the Ethics Board an individual who worked on town Councilman John Froelich's campaign and also served as an election commissioner for him at the polling place.
A day after Mayor Bill de Blasio said it was time for New York State to ban plastic bags, Governor Cuomo stated that he was considering such a proposal. Cuomo last year agreed with the state legislature and blocked New York City from implementing a law to impose a fee on plastic bags. Cuomo at the time said he would appoint a task force to make a recommendation for a statewide solution, but the task force report issued in January made no such proposal. Environmental advocates want the governor to include a plastic bag ban in the budget negotiations.
The Legal Aid Society is asking Governor Cuomo to protect local counties, namely Rensselaer, from participating in a program that deputizes local authorities as immigration agents. Last month, Rensselaer County Sheriff Patrick Russo opted into a partnership with ICE known as 287G. Two corrections officers in the Sheriff's Department will soon have authority to question suspects about their immigration statuses and detain them for deportation. Rensselaer is the only county in New York participating in the program.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Now we have Julia Kavicki and Carolyn Kessner in from Skidmore College discussing combined sewer overflows in the Capital Region. Welcome to the program. Julia and Carolyn.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you. So we are working on an interdisciplinary research project on combined sewer overflows in the Capital Region. Now, for listeners who don't know, CSOs are a major issue both nationwide and specifically in the capital region. And with these outdated sewer systems, rainwater, household sewage, and industrial wastewater are all collected into one pipe. And normally, all of this water is treated at the wastewater treatment plant. But when there's too much rain or for other reasons, the wastewater bypasses the plant, and all of the water, including fecal bacteria, antihistamines, caffeine, microplastics, and hormones, all of this spills straight into the Hudson River. And so as part of our research project, I've been looking at the history of the outdated sewer systems, how they came to be the way they are, also how it's politically managed, and possibilities for improvement, including green infrastructure practices and some other things that can help to kind of mitigate this issue. And I'm here with Carolyn Kestner, who's also working on the project. And I was wondering if you could just introduce yourself and what sort of you're looking at specifically as part of this project.
Yeah, so Julia's kind of working on the social side of this project, but me and my partner are working on the science side of this project. So we're doing once a month water quality testing at 6 different sites on the Hudson River throughout Albany and Troy. We started doing this in November, and we're going to be doing our last one next month it's March already. So we've been doing this once a month water testing in the quote-unquote off-season of CSOs. Most of the agencies that monitor the CSOs currently, they only do it from May to October because that's traditionally the season in which CSOs have been happening. But now, because of climate change, we've been experiencing a lot more non-snow precipitation during the quote-unquote off-season. And so we've been experiencing a lot more CSOs in our off-season. Those of you who live in the area may have seen that the Hudson was overflowing about a week and a half ago after we had that foot of snow and then about an inch of rain on top of it. So we tested that day, and the results did not look good. They were way off the chart. Our bacteria levels were way off the charts for EPA-safe swimming levels.
Yeah, so I went along on that water sampling trip, and I've got some notes from the field audio to share from that visit. And then you'll also hear from Joe Coffey, who's the commissioner of the Albany Water Board, speak a bit about what he's been seeing in terms of precipitation and CSO events in the capital region.
So we're parked at a U-Haul in Albany, but behind you right now, like that cement wall, is the Big C, which is the largest outflow pipe in the capital region. It
accounts for, I think, 40% of the total discharge just from a single pipe.
Which in the last 72 hours is a lot of discharge. We've been here sometimes after storms where it's been like releasing and it kind of bubbles a little bit, but I think the water's high enough where we won't even be able to see the pipes.
Yeah, there's a layer like of like greasy looking stuff on top.
It's like an oil slick without all the color. This little tiny bottle that we're filling up right now measures turbidity, which is like how cloudy the water is. Pretty cloudy.
How does it read the turbidity?
Light levels.
Yeah.
So it puts light through the bottle. The amount of light that gets through to like the other side is how you tell how cloudy the water is.
106!
Oh my god.
Oh my god.
That's
really
the highest I've ever seen. We had spring melt, I think, probably earlier than people were anticipating. Usually we get it more in March, and it's like almost the end of February.
Well, it's mid-February, and it was 70 degrees on Wednesday.
So that's an anomaly temperature-wise.
I've been a commissioner for 4 years. What we have experienced, I think, in the past 4 years is that when there are significant precipitation events, they're more extreme. The thunderstorm events, the significant, intense rainfall events, are much more intense. Most of the larger streams in Albany now are all piped. It's a question of more and more development. And when it was done, like a lot of the old urban areas, the sanitary wastewater was combined with the stormwater. Well, if it's raining, it's probably overflowing.
Great. So we heard there that you were testing for turbidity. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the other things that you're testing out in the field.
Yeah, so we test for turbidity, as you heard. We also do dissolved oxygen, which is a measure of how much oxygen is in the water. So if those levels get too low, then there isn't enough water or oxygen in the water for, say, healthy fish communities. Just like if there wasn't enough oxygen in the air for us to breathe, that would be a serious problem. What else do we test for? We test for conductivity, which is kind of a measure of how much salt is in the water. But we've been experiencing problems with our meter because the water's been very cold, so it hasn't been working completely properly. But the main thing we test for is two different types of fecal coliform indicator bacteria. So we test for E. coli and Enterococcus. I'm sure a lot of people have heard of E. coli, but maybe not Enterococcus. And basically, they're indicator bacteria. So if you have high levels of these bacteria, you're probably going to have high levels of other harmful bacteria in the water. If you go swimming in the water when there's high levels of these bacteria, you'll probably get some sort of gastrointestinal disease, or it's likely to happen. So by testing the levels of bacteria, you can kind of assess the risk of swimming in the water. So we test for EPA standards. The Enterococcus ones, off the top of my head, I believe are about 80 cells per 100 milliliters, and then E. coli, I believe, is 160, but don't quote me on that, but somewhere around that range. And so if it's above those levels were created with the idea in mind of 32 illnesses per 1,000 swimmers. So anything above that range, who knows how many people could get sick from potentially swimming in the river, but that's kind of what we're looking at when we test our water. And so our preliminary results, they're not looking super great. We haven't had a single site pass both of our fecal coliform bacteria tests. They've all failed E. coli, which is interesting because currently all the organizations that are not us only test the water for Enterococcus. So we've had a few sites that have passed Enterococcus but failed E. coli, which could mean potentially that the water is still unsafe to swim in it, even though it failed one or it passed one of the tests. An interesting thing to note is that our part of the Hudson River, basically from Albany to Troy, is not actually classified as a swimming water body. It's classified as a Class C water body in New York State, which means you can participate in non-contact recreation, which is basically kayaking, boating, anything like that. But if anyone's ever gone kayaking or rowing, you know you get wet. It also doesn't mean that it doesn't keep people from interacting with the river. I know from personal experience when we've gone out in the river, we've seen people fishing on the river. We saw people ice fishing too, and you're definitely getting wet in those activities. And I know other organizations have documented people swimming in our area of the river. So just because it says that it's not classified for swimming doesn't mean that people don't. And so people are still at risk from our water bodies. So, yeah.
Thanks.
Sorry. I'm just really interested in the topic. Of course, it's not classed for swimming. I wonder a little about the risk to people eating fish from the river also.
Yeah, we're still not 100% clear of the effects of CSOs on fish. Mainly the warnings for fish in our area are due to PCBs in the river, which have really come from the old factories that were dumping into the river. So that's not necessarily the risk that we're looking at with CSOs, though the verdict's still out on to how, you know, that buildup of the bacteria in the fish could affect people. But
and there are also other issues like pharmaceuticals or things that might be in the sewage that we're not entirely sure how all those different chemicals interact with each other in the fish and in the people who might be eating them.
Yeah. But the big warning, kind of all the signs you'll see around the area of not to eat the fish is because of the PCBs, not necessarily because of the CSOs. But
But fish health definitely is a huge issue in the Hudson River, and particularly I've been in touch with some of the New York public health folks who are working on fish outreach, and one of the major issues they've been talking about is that a lot of the people who are fishing on the rivers are newcomers to the area. And so that means that, A, they might not speak English as well, and so they might not read the signs or know as much about the history of the river, which is the other issue, is that they're new and they don't know about this long history of both PCB contamination and combined sewer overflows in the river. And so they're the ones who are more in contact with it, and they're the ones that are more susceptible to being, to eating the fish and themselves also getting contaminated with these chemicals. So it's definitely a major issue.
Yeah.
I'd also like to know, just on the social side, Julia, you mentioned that you're doing some work on the history of the problem.
Yeah.
From a contemporary perspective, it seems like combining those systems of runoff is a terrible design idea.
Yes.
Can you talk about why we decided to do that?
Yeah, so there's sort of this common understanding that, you know, folks didn't really have this idea of separating out sewer systems until more recently, and so we've inherited this old infrastructure because of that. But it turns out that even as early as the, you know, early 1800s, there were places like in Lenox, Massachusetts, that knew that it was a good idea to separate the systems. But it was just sort of an economic concern that it was just cheaper to have it be combined. And so that's kind of how things have come into place and what we have to work with. But a lot of these pipes are, you know, as old as the Dutch. There's some, I mean, down at the Albany Water Commissioner, you can see these wooden pipes that are from, you know, up to 200 years ago that are still what is carrying our waste and water through the city. So it's pretty remarkable. And also you can see where a lot of old streams that used to come through the city have now been diverted into pipes. And so all these streams are also mixing in with all of this in the same underground system.
All right, I'd like to thank you, Julia Kavicki and Carolyn Kessner, for coming in from Skidmore College to talk about combined sewer overflows. Is there anywhere we could find out more about your work?
Yes, we'll be posting on an online website that we will be sharing with the Media Sanctuary. So if folks would like to get in touch with us, we can share some of our findings that way. And we'll also be collaborating with the Ruderal Ecologies Conference that Nature Lab is hosting in April.
All right, thank you. All right, so once again, that was Julia Kavicki and Carolyn Kessner from Skidmore College discussing combined sewer overflows in the Capital Region.
How do artists learn to survive in the 21st century economy? Local visual artist Kim Kateo is also a WOOC correspondent, and she sat down with a few of her classmates from the Business of Art Extended Series at the Art Center of the Capital Region in downtown Troy. They discuss what they've learned about fusing creativity with the ability to make a living.
Hi, I'm WOOC correspondent Kim Tadio. I am also an artist, and I'm taking the Business of Art Extended Series course at the Art Center of the Capital Region. It's been a really interesting course, and I'm really enjoying working with my fellow artists and getting to know each other, so I thought it'd be a great opportunity for us to come together, learn about some of the artists in the Capital Region, and more about the project. So a little bit more about the class itself. The Business of Art Extended Series is an extensive program focused on the artist as an entrepreneur. Over the course of the seventh-month program, artists learn the importance of developing their persona and managing their business in order to leave with the tools and confidence to turn their creative ventures into success. The funding is provided by the KeyBank Foundation and the Workforce Development Institute. I'm here with fellow artists Katie, Janine, and Jennifer. Can you all say hi?
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. So we're going to just go through and talk about some things. This class is meant to help transform us and grow as artists. So can anyone tell me how this, so far, it's working?
For me, it's been really helpful in finding out ways to balance both the artistic voice and actually how to be profitable so you can pay bills and grow your business and create a greater impact overall with your work.
Thanks, Katie. And I mean, I think that's one of the things as artists, we, you know, there's often a thing of us being starving artists and not making it, but this class is sort of meant to help us grow beyond that.
Yeah, I agree. As a writer, I spend a lot of my time writing, being in the creative process. And before this class, I was not a business person at all. Didn't know anything about balance sheets, profit and loss. And so this has really helped me to focus my attention, kind of balance it between the creativity and the business end of it, because I do want to do it as my career.
Jennifer, you have anything to add?
I'm a little bit different. I've had a design studio for 25 years. I've had my own design studio for 25 years. So I've got the business side, I've got the creative side, but I'm at a transition point in my life. And so I'm trying to think about what my next steps are and re-examine my business model. So that's where I am right now.
Katie, can you tell me a little bit about your art? Like, what do you do?
Yeah, certainly. My business is called Snaggletooth, and I make prints and patterns for textiles that then are turned into accessories and bags. And the whole goal is to focus different ecosystems around the world and really showcase and inspire all that what's out there.
Great. How about you, Janine?
I'm president of Highland Mountain Publishing. So I own my own publishing company and do the writing. And I write middle grade novels that help the they soften the harshness of reality and help build friendships with children and provides hope.
And this is Jennifer, and I have my design studio, Aurora Design, and then I also have an art photography business where I, that was sort of a big leap. Oops. I'm also an art photographer, and so I'm sort of looking to grow that part of my life right now.
That's great. Well, maybe that was more of a, you know, setting a goal and intention that was, you know, deep. Maybe it wasn't a, you know, yeah. There you go. All right. So some more questions. Like, so we started this class back in November. Mm-hmm. Has anything changed? Are people doing anything differently since it started?
I think for me, definitely it's been super helpful focusing on that profit and loss and breaking down how much materials there actually are and all the overhead that goes into running a business to actually see what works and what doesn't and adjusting my products to make them more applicable for like consumers and the market that I'm gearing towards.
Yeah, I've had a lot of big changes in that. My husband has become my business manager. There's air quotes there. So he is handling the books, QuickBooks, and really has helped me to be more efficient with how I'm spending my money, what my goals are, having a specific budget, and making goals as far as when I want to publish my books and how I want to use the business, you know, for the future, and not just writing books and putting them out there, kind of having a focus and goals in mind.
I'm not really sure if a lot of my changes have come out of the class or if the class has been part of my changes in my life. But one of the things I've been doing is reaching out to a lot of other artists. So almost every week since the class started, I've been sitting down with other artists and business people and talking about different business models. So I've been exploring how I might shape my business to move forward. The other thing that I came to, wanting to grow my photography, I realized that while I love photography and it serves an important purpose in my life, it's not going to make me money. And so I have to keep doing the design thing and refocus that and bring the photography along at the same time. But really, my primary focus has to be on my design work.
Great. One of the things I think that we talk about sometimes are learning a difference between a hobbyist and then maybe how the IRS would classify us as artists. How has that impacted your art or your creative process?
For me, it's definitely been balancing both because with my work, I really want to create good and create awareness over certain ecological issues. So trying to find where that fits into people's everyday life and how that works on like the greater vision scheme has been really important.
As an artist, you know, we have a purpose and a mission. I have a pretty strong mission that no matter what I write, I want to be able to inspire people to and provide hope. But I also, part of that is teaching people how to write and find their own voice so that they can be empowered to make a difference in their life and everyone else's life. So teaching classes is also a part of it. And taking that more of a business end has really helped me to branch out and get more, you know, teaching opportunities.
Sure. Originally, I found that topic to be slightly disheartening, or I mean, if I'm going to be honest about it, just because I was like, oh, so that determines I'm an artist and I feel like I'm always an artist. But what I can appreciate and what I'm learning is that it is okay to be an artist and it is also okay to make money off of your art. You know, it's an exchange of, it's just an exchange for that art. And so I think as long as we're all still creating and finding ways to do that and, you know, not having it get us down, that's important. Are there any upcoming shows or events that you guys want to talk about or, you know, things that, you know, you're excited about, either personally or collectively as a class?
This is Jennifer, and I have a piece in the Small Works show up at the Shirt Factory Gallery right now, and I was up there last weekend for their opening reception, which was a ton of fun. Great exhibit in a great space. But the one thing I'm really excited about, and you guys don't know this yet, I was just accepted into a group show at Photo Expressions Gallery.
Yay.
And so I'm not sure how many artists have been selected, but last year there were about five, so I think I'm one of five. So that's really exciting. But now I've got to gulp, go get the pieces framed and printed, so there goes there goes several hundred
Wonderful.
Dollars.
But that's also part of it. It's, you know, raising awareness about your art. If you have, you know, a mission that you want to produce with your art and to share with people, it's important. I mean, I don't necessarily do shows. You know, I don't have any book signings coming up, but I am teaching in the schools and my writer's journals with the students. So that has really been fun because just seeing kids get excited about building a character and their own personal, maybe if they have something that they're working through, they can work through it by utilizing a character. And so just seeing how your art can positively affect people is wonderful. So I think the shows are fantastic to be able to.
Katie, are you doing anything exciting that you look forward to?
At the moment, I'm gearing up for craft season, which is always in the summer. So it's determining like what craft shows to apply for and fingers crossing that you get accepted into them and all that. And then we are going to have a show in May that will feature the whole class's work. I'm sure you'll be all hearing about that as these interviews go on. And that's what's going on.
Kim, what do you have going on?
I actually have some work up at Carmen's Cafe in South Troy. So that's up for a month or so if you guys want to come see it. I had a little opening reception, which was really fun. And we did some impromptu painting. I decided to bring some paints and have people paint with me, because for me, my process is sort of about showing it and kind of expressing and, you know, doing that. So it was really fun. I think one of the really exciting things about this class actually has been, we talked about connections to other artists, but I think connections to each other. Does anyone want to talk about that and how that's either been important to them or not important? Maybe it's like not.
can I jump in?
Yeah, of course.
When I first sat there the first day and everybody was introducing themselves, it was a little overwhelming and everybody kind of blurred together, to be honest. And I thought, oh my God, I'm like the oldest one in the room and I have nothing in common with all these people. And then you realize, well, first of all, I'm not the oldest in the room. Amen. And then that we all still have exactly the same struggles, exactly the same things that we're thinking about, has been just so much fun. It's been delightful getting to know everybody. I really have enjoyed it.
I realize how much I need to learn about art, or how much more I want to learn about it. And even though as a writer, I took a drawing class at the Art Center just because I was so connecting with everyone, all these visual artists. So really connecting with everyone, networking and getting to know people has been wonderful. I've enjoyed it.
And then I went to art school and since then haven't really been able to find the art tribe that I really enjoyed and really benefited from an art school. So this has been a wonderful opportunity to meet people with like minds and similar motives.
Well, thank you so much for having this interview and having this discussion. And hopefully we have more. There are 12 artists in this class total. And you may hear from some people again, or maybe new artists. If anything, we'll just tell you about our upcoming show. I know we also have something in September, which will help kick off the next season of the Business of Art Extended Series. The Art Center is a great resource. It's located in Troy. And the Art Center of the Capital Region has other classes. They have classes for kids, classes for adults. Well, thanks so much for being here today. And just once more again, I'm going to go down the line. And if you can tell me your name and the artwork that you do and how people can find you.
Certainly. So my name is Katie Bierman. You can find my work either on my website, katherinelynnbierman.com, or at Instagram via Schnaggletooth, and that's SCH Schnaggletooth.
And I'm Janine Camerata. My company is Highland Mountain Publishing, and my latest book is The Puzzle Quest, Shimmer's Eggs. You can find my information on my website at highlandpub.com or on Instagram at Janine Camerata.
And I'm Jennifer Wilkerson, and my company is Aurora Design, and you can find it at thoughtfuldesign.com. And from there, you can link to any of my social media profiles.
And my name is Kim Tadio, and if you're interested in finding my work, you can look up lookalittlecloser.com or look a little closer on Instagram as well. And we just want to tell you a little bit more about the Art Center and how you can find this class. And if you're interested in applying for it, it will start again next September. It is a juried process, which sounds scary, but it's not too bad. It's just more about finding out more about you. And this information is on www.artcenteronline.org.
That was local artist and WOOC correspondent Kim Tadio speaking about the business of art. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, or to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. Now we have the Alt's Luke Stoddard, Nathan, to talk about stories in the upcoming issue. Welcome, Luke.
Thanks for having me.
What do you have for us, Luke?
I have a couple stories. One, which I didn't write about this week, but which it was maybe a pretty big story this week, is that the City of Troy has put out a new RFP for design related services related to the One Monument Square project. You might recall that One Monument Square most recently was going to have a movie theater, but that project fell through, just like a number of other projects have fallen through. And so this time, again, like before, the city is putting out an RFP to have a consultant kind of oversee a multi-step process, which would involve public meetings, which would kind of be designed to determine what would happen with that site. So part of it would decide kind of what is the best use for the actual Monument Square site, which I should say is a very complicated site. There's a road that runs through it. There's a public portion, like a 50-foot strip that needs to be retained by the river for a public park. And the city is asking that that there be some sort of public access to the river from River Street through the site in some manner to the river. And so it's a complicated site. And so the design, this consultant who they would hire would oversee the public meetings, and they would also kind of prepare the construction documents. So they would sort of set the stage for the site to kind of move forward once again, maybe. And I can say just one more thing about this. I was talking to none other than Vic Christopher just before I got here, who's kind of maybe famous or notorious, depending on your perspective, about for his kind of – he was maybe the most prominent supporter of the last project before it fell through the movie theater. And he was really excited, actually, about – and he's been kind of down on the whole – on the city's process in the way it's handled things, especially in the last round. And he was really excited about this most recent RFP because he thought that the city was kind of handling it well this time in terms of having this consultant kind of set – make sure that – just help the city kind of navigate this process.
Can you talk a little about what happened with the movie theater?
Yeah. It was put out to bid in late December of 2016, and the project was eventually awarded to a combination team of Bowtie Cinemas and Bonaccio Construction. They were going to build a big multi-screen movieplex. There was some public opposition, but what really seemed to stop it in its tracks was a lawsuit brought by a neighboring property owner, Sam Judge, who owns property on both sides of the site. And he raised a whole bunch of complicated arguments, raising questions about whether the city was able to sell some of the public land and other sort of complications. And now, and since the project fell apart, Bowtie Cinemas is now suing the city to try to recoup the money that it spent on its proposal and stuff. So it's a complicated site. It has felled many aspiring developers. You have to wonder at this point, like, who would even want to take this project on at this point? Like, if you're someone who's considering investing a lot of money. And, you know, there's continued, I think, public, you know, members of the public really are concerned about making sure there's enough parking at that site. Other people are like, who cares about parking? Like, let's try to move toward a more transit-oriented kind of city. Everybody has ideas about, like, what should happen at that site. And it seems unlikely that it won't be rancorous moving forward, although maybe there's a way to, I don't know, maybe there's a way to smooth it out. But the city hasn't found one yet.
Luke, mentioned that there had to be some property set aside for access to the river. Would that property be adjoining the memorials, the square or not?
Right. So So there would be some sort of steps or pathway from the square down into that, and it would and then the public area would connect to the park, the strip kind of most close to the Hudson River would also connect to the park. So there would be public access kind of both ways. But it's complicated. The other story that I worked on this past week, or the story rather that I actually did write, is that the Troy Community Land Bank, which is a sort of it is a nonprofit. It's also a state-authorized public authority. Maybe that's too much legalese. But in any case, it's sort of this interesting hybrid entity that is only kind of a recent invention. And what they do is buy properties in the North Central neighborhood, especially distressed properties, fix them up or demolish them, and then try to sell them to people who hopefully owner occupants or people who will rent, you know, will kind of be around. Not, in other words, not just sell to absentee landlords or people who are trying to flip the properties immediately and make a quick buck. They have kind of taken on this new project where they are in the process of acquiring four adjacent lots at the northwest corner of Glen and River Street. And what they want to do eventually, once certain properties are demolished, is partner with CDTA and maybe the State Affordable Housing Agency and maybe also the federal Troy Housing Authority to create some sort of mixture of retail on the bottom floor on this big four-parcel lot and some kind of affordable housing on the upper floors with ample space for a bus station that would be part of the bus rapid transit line that CDTA is planning, pending the receipt of federal funds and yada, yada, yada. But eventually, CDTA wants to build this rapid transit line that goes from Cohoes down through Albany with only about 2 dozen stops. That would kind of be a rapid transit line. And the idea is that this would kind of be a kind of keystone project in North Central that would help, you know, kind of stabilize the neighborhood, so to speak.
What kinds of responses have folks in the Glen Ave area been having to the project?
That's a good question. And to be honest, I haven't gone door to door, you know, and asking about this. I do know that the Conyers, a family that owns one of the parcels, were at this meeting that I was at last week when the land bank authorized the project, and you know, they're selling their land to the land bank for about $60,000. And they seemed pleased to be selling it. But that's an interesting question. And it's one that I think the land bank, which is still fairly new, although they've just started to sort of ramp up their operations, but they have been around for a couple of years. I think that's going to be an interesting conversation that they're going to be continuing to have with the community around here. Like, how do we make sure that we have these big plans? We want to do this bus rapid transit center. Are we, let's make sure that we're seeking enough feedback from the community. And, you know, so I guess the jury's still out on that one as far as like how they feel, how people around here feel about the land bank kind of acquiring properties and selling them and that sort of thing.
Is there, give me some background on the requirement for transportation. Where would it go and who would it serve?
Yeah, I mean, here's one thing I can say about that. The sort of focal point of this line is supposed to be the Uncle Sam Transit Center, which is this long planned kind of hub that would be down in downtown Troy at the Uncle Sam Garage currently, which is owned by David Bryce. But CDTA and David Bryce have gotten in this real kind of long protracted dispute over, first they were in negotiations for some sort of lease, long-term lease, but then that kind of stalled out. And so now CDTA is pursuing eminent domain to take a certain sliver of land kind of next to that. But I think that stop, I don't have statistics off the top of my head in terms of this whole line, but I can say that stop, if built, is projected to have something like 4,000 riders a day and serve something like a bunch of different lines would come through there. And so I think the blue line, as it's called, this rapid transit line that I was telling you about, though, I believe that CDTA projected that it would be like one of the third most popular line or something like that. So I think it's one of three rapid transit lines that they're planning. One's already built. It's the red line. It's the one that goes from Albany to Schenectady. And then there's another one, a purple line that's going to be somewhere over by kind of UAlbany area. I'm not sure exactly where. I don't have that in front of me. But then, and then the other third one is the Cohoes to Albany one that goes through Troy. So that's a little bit more background. I don't know if those are exactly the statistics you were looking for, but
no, it was informative.
Yeah.
All right. I think that's all the time we have for Luke. Thank you very much, Luke, for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Where can people find these stories in the Alton Online?
We are distributed all over the place in the Capital District and then also thealt.com. As always, you can find all my work there. So,
great. Thanks. Thank you. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM.
Next, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine brings you WOOC reporter Dan Pfeiffer, who recently spoke to Surya Matu about smart homes, unsecured databases at Mar-a-Lago, and some of the things our devices are whispering about us that we might not even realize. Surya is a resident at iBeam in New York City and a resident of iBeam's R&D program for the future of journalism.
We think of it kind of loosely as like a detective agency, but a lot of the research we're doing, we're trying to focus on adversarial research, which we mean looking at the ways technical systems and technologies work, but including within the kind of scope of a technology or algorithmic system, the humans that we make them, and trying to understand like where does the accountability and sort of liability for these systems that are like driving our lives fall, and how can we do research that is actionable, that can be used by advocates, educators, lawyers to kind of steer the conversation around the influence of technology in society. And what we're actually doing is we've been going through all of Facebook's terms of service and privacy policies and seeing how they've evolved and changed over time and mapping to them all the legal cases, FTC complaints, and anything else we can find in the public discourse to understand like how these companies have managed to, for 15 years, skirt any kind of accountability and be able to kind of operate and regulate themselves without having any precedent set in the law. Just as a way to kind of understand this bigger conversation around this space. It's like they have a privacy policy in terms of service. And when they do that, it's still on us to find how they violate their own services for them to get into trouble. So there's no easy... So even if you read that stuff, it doesn't necessarily tell you what they're doing. It's just telling you what they're saying they're doing.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So I have this really strong visual of you from an earlier project. You're on a boat offshore from Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort holding this huge Wi-Fi antenna. What was going on there?
Yes, I was on a boat in front of Mar-a-Lago, and that was basically an investigation that Jeff Larson, Julia Angwin, and I were doing, which was basically it started really as an investigation of the Trump resort phone apps. We found, we had downloaded like all the apps for like the different golf resorts that Trump has, and we were looking through the data packets we were going through, and we found this URL to a database that looked really unencrypted and unsafe. And the reason we went to Mar-a-Lago was to actually just do like an odd, like a survey of the land, the kind of network infrastructure landscape. So the way to think about it is like we were sitting on our laptops, looking through all the network names that were coming up as we drove around to get a sense for like how many were open, how many were closed, and this type of stuff. And we found some like scary stuff. Like, for example, we found that one of the databases for Mar-a-Lago's backend services actually is loaded over HTTP, the login, which basically means that if someone is like listening in on that network, they can see the credentials to the one of Mar-a-Lago's databases.
You had a quote from a security expert who was saying, we should assume that this has been compromised.
Right. Yeah, because we got there in June of 2017. Trump was already president. The real spies and the real, like, the people who are like experts in this space have probably already figured it all out.
More recently, you did an experiment with Gizmodo journalist Kashmir Hill to snoop on kinds of things, on what kinds of things internet-connected smart products reveal about their users. What did you learn from that?
So when we did this experiment, the real folk, we were less interested in this question from a cybersecurity perspective. Like, we weren't really thinking about, like, who can hack into my devices and how safe are they? We were more thinking about like, what are the ambient emissions of a smart home? What does it look like from a network level to live at a smart home? So the way I like kind of pitched the experiment to Cash was, imagine I am the receptionist of your house and every packet that is coming and going, I just know about. If it's a postcard, I can see what's written on it. If it's a sealed envelope, I can't see what's inside, but I can see that it came and went. And we were just really curious for like different devices. How often do they talk to their servers? What kind of information are they sharing? Could we find any patterns in just the way the house is being lived in through these devices? And we could. We found like some interesting stuff. You know, like I knew when Cash woke up, I knew what sound app, what Alexa app she used to put her kid to sleep and wake her up. I knew when they watched TV. I knew when she brushed her teeth. And this is just all stuff that Comcast, her ISP, could see. And that was the real motivation, because the U.S. government passed a law last year that said they're allowed to sell that data again. They repealed the previous law, which prevented them from doing so. We were just curious what Comcast could see and what they could actually monetize off that data.
She has this quote that says, smart homes are dumb. And it seems like it's an article that's as much about how overblown the hype is for a lot of these products, that they're not as smart as they make themselves out to be.
I think that's basically what I think our biggest finding is, that they're kind of creepy, but they're really annoying. And it really made us kind of think about the fact that, you know, like, The current contract we've kind of all agreed upon with these technology companies is that you give us stuff for free and we give you our data in exchange. And that made sense, I think, in like 2005 when like Gmail was giving you gigabytes of inbox space versus Yahoo's 5 MB, right? Like that made like, that seemed to feel like, yeah, that's worth it. I'll give that up. But now I feel like the models flip where not only do you buy a $1,000 smart TV and use it, but they also then collect your data, and we don't even think about it because we just take it for granted that that's what's going to happen.
For a few weeks, I had your Facebook friend recommendation tracker running. Could you describe what it does and why you made it?
That was part of an investigation we've been carrying out for the last year around Facebook's people you may know algorithm. When we started this investigation, we were just curious to understand how Facebook suggests people to each other, because that's actually the kind of crux of their business model, is having this massive social graph of people, and they like it when more people are connected to each other because it increases the resolution. So we were just curious how they actually kind of implemented this, and I built us an internal tool, like this internal scraping tool that let us collect all the people. I was being suggested, Cash was being suggested, and we wrote a bunch of stories through this. But what we realized soon after writing these stories was that it was hard to show the harm that this algorithm was doing wasn't actually in the math. It was more in who was not being considered for these decisions. So what we actually found was that the LGBTQ community and sex workers were the most harmed by this algorithm because they had no way of turning it off. So if, for example, as a person, as some LGBTQ people told us that they have like a cis identity and a queer identity, and they had both Facebook accounts on their phones, and what Facebook would do was suggest, because the phone was the same, the contacts are the same for both apps, so like someone's mom got suggested that queer identity, someone's old client, so like there's all this stuff that happened, and there's no way for us to navigate that. Facebook doesn't allow that option, the interface. So the reason we built that app was we wanted our readers and users to collect their own data and share their stories with us, because that's how we wanted to hold the challenges of this algorithm to account. We hear so many anecdotes of how people have these experiences, but none of it's recorded in a way that we can actually take it, like raise it to a higher level. So that's kind of, that sort of anecdote exists. It was exactly the motivation of the app.
Let's see. So, a while back, you showed me a tool that you're working on called Herbivore, which looked like a great way to learn about computer networks. How is that coming along?
Herbivore is like a network inspection tool. It's sort of like a packet sniffer. If people have heard of Wireshark, which is like an old version of this, it's a thing that's existed for a long time. The real motivation for behind Herbivore, though, was to build a tool that allows us to talk about computer networks more from the perspective of the politics of the companies involved in that conversation and less from just the technical layer. So what it tries to do is get you to the part where you're actually seeing how your devices are communicating with servers of companies and what information is being transacted and what the motivations behind that information being shared could be and how that affects you. So kind of really like the goal was to really take the sniffing part of packet sniffing to the next degree, where saying, instead of telling you how something works, can we make you smell how a network feels?
I love that metaphor. How does a network smell?
Yeah, because like, it's a different response. Like, that's gross. Or like, that's nice. But it's different to like, how do I feel about this? In like a abstract way.
So I understand you're going to be a TED speaker. That's kind of weird and amazing. Are you preparing your talk? What is that process like?
That was totally out of the blue. So when we released the smart home story 2 weeks ago, the next day we got an email from one of the people who curates the TED speakers and said, hey, there's this conference happening in 2 months and we'd love for you to come and talk about the story with us. And I was like, what? and I guess privacy still fits within the concerns of the neoliberal model, so it makes sense that TED wants us to come there. But we're going to talk about the story, and we're currently in the middle of like figuring out what the big idea is. And I think like what I'm going to tease out is how do you frame privacy in a way that's not about like the effects to an individual, but to us as a community.
That was Dan Pfeiffer talking to Surya Matu as part of his series on data justice. To learn more about Surya's projects, you can visit suryamatu.com. That's S-U-R-Y-A-M-A-T-T-U.com. WOOC correspondent Kristen Copper visited Dr. Ng, who is a professor in the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Department at University at Albany. Beyond her teaching profession, Dr. Ng is a historian and a documentary filmmaker. Her current documentary film, On Her Own Terms, is in production. Dr. Ng discussed her path to becoming a documentary filmmaker and how storytelling can be a tool of empowerment.
I didn't know that I was a good storyteller until maybe 20 years ago. I started writing a short story as a result of an incident at Port Authority in New York. I was waiting for a bus to New Jersey to visit a friend, and I was sitting there minding my own business, and all of a sudden a woman came up to me and asked, "How do you define intimidation?" I was taken aback. I said, "Ooh, you know, is this person crazy or what?" So I said, there was a Hudson News stand somewhere near the waiting area, and said, "Well, why don't you look it up in the dictionary?" I was really short with her. So she left, but I started thinking about her. I said, why would a person out of the blue ask me this question? Then I started creating a scenario for that encounter, and it became a short story called Bus Stop. While I wrote it, a friend of mine who was a professor at CUNY Law School, Ruth Ann Robson, came to visit me in Oklahoma. I thought about, I mean, she's a published short story and actually novel a writer, and I was pretty shy about sharing, you know, but I decided to be brave, and so I showed her my manuscript, and she read it and she said, "Vivian, that's really good, send it off." So I did, and she recommended a journal. I did, and they accepted it, and the editor was so nice, she wrote back and said, "Vivian, you are a good storyteller." And that was when my skill, my talent was confirmed. But that's only writing. It's not, you know, making documentary film. I've always looked at things literally, visually. Before I started making films, I was interested in making websites and telling interactive stories. So I would, there was another story that I've written, and I decided to incorporate it into a website. And I learned how to make code so people can click on a particular link and come up with a different scenario and so forth. And I love that. But that's not filmmaking. But that's, I think it's a progress toward making film. Then around the year 2000, I got hold of some manuscripts of my grandfather, my mother's father. He was a filmmaker. I didn't know that when he was alive, and by reading his manuscripts, I started imagining what it would be like for him to make films and what it would be like for me to make films from his stories and his screenplays that he never had a chance to do. So that got me thinking seriously about making films, but not documentary films, mm-hmm. not yet.
Huh. So then how did you start to make the switch from film to documentary films?
Well, by chance. The first documentary film I was involved in was Trailblazers in Habits, about the Mary Knoll nuns who were active in Hong Kong, China, Bolivia, United States. And a friend of mine was involved in the planning of that film. And for some reason, she thought, since my grandfather was a filmmaker, I must have filmmaking genes in me. So I was visiting Hong Kong one spring break, and this friend said, "You know, Nancy Tong is making this film. Why don't you meet her? Because you'll get along, and then you can get involved with the film, because you obviously you can make film." I said, "I've never made a film before, but okay, I'm willing to meet with Nancy." I didn't know then that Nancy Tong was an award-winning documentary filmmaker, and she was a director of this really important documentary called In the Name of the Emperor, about the massacre in Nanking by the Chinese by Japanese. And so I met with Nancy. At first, she was kind of put off, "You know, who are you?" But we hit it off. And so we decided to collaborate. She's based in Toronto, I'm based in Albany. And that was the beginning of my love affair with documentary filmmaking.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So how do you think film can be used to empower women?
I think film as a medium is neutral. I mean, I can think of many films, documentary films too, that have been used to demean people, destroy people. For example, one filmmaker whose work I admire very much, and I kind of hesitate to mention that, is Leni Riefenstahl. She was a German filmmaker who made Triumph of the Will and the Berlin Olympics. I mean, gorgeous films. Very powerful. I mean, so powerful that she could actually be accused of committing war crime. That was how good she was, how good the films were. So films by themselves do not empower women, even though the filmmaker, in this case, Riefenstahl, was herself a woman. But the medium can be definitely used to empower women or anybody if the intent is to allow certain individuals, particularly those who had been denied a voice, to give voice to their experience, to tell their own stories.
Mm-hmm. So is that why storytelling is so important to you, to give voice to these people?
I'm a historian. I mean, that's my PhD. I live and breathe being a historian without being conscious of it. I mean, that's how much I am a historian. I mean, this doesn't mean I dwell on the past. It's just that, you know, I am curious about what happened in the past. I'm curious about anything. And then I want to get the bottom of something. So it's almost, if I were not a historian, probably I would be an investigative journalist. I mean, that's what I am. To be effective, though, if you have you've discovered something and you want to share that information with somebody, storytelling or writing in a way that people can relate to is the most effective way to disseminate information and to share your ideas. So even in my history writing, I try to write like a storyteller.
So do you think your work as a historian and a women's studies professor influences your films and the subjects you choose to film about?
Well, since I just said that I live and breathe being a historian, obviously, that certainly had affected the topics I choose to make films about. Even if the subject is a living person, like the artist that I'm making a film about, in order to tell her story, to make her story more complete, I have to do research on her family's history and the context of her family's past. So if let's say her great-grandparents lived in Virginia, well, what was Virginia like, Richmond, Virginia, like in the 19th century, just to flesh out the context. So the subject herself may not be aware because, you know, we don't know. We can't just answer questions. What was it like in 19th century when your family lived there? It's up to the filmmaker to tell that, to offer that context. So yes, being a historian has shaped the way I tell my stories via film.
So film is a field that's typically dominated by men. What advice would you give to women who aspire to make films?
Persevere. Don't give up. And don't be afraid to fail.
That was WOOC correspondent Kristen Copper with Dr. Eng, a documentary filmmaker and professor at University of Albany. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm Ray Kotke. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.